The following program is a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.
The acceptance of the one-minute manager and the three secrets, one-minute praising, one-minute reprimanding, and one-minute goal-setting, as easy to understand and use concepts, has almost been complete throughout the world in the last year and a half. Over 2 million hardback books have been sold in the United States and 18 language translations around the world. With that kind of record, you might want to ask what more needs to be done. The reality is that most companies spend all their time trying to find the next new management concept and never follow up what they just taught their people. It is for this very reason that I decided to join with Robert Lauber, an outstanding productivity improvement expert, on the sequel to The One-Minute Manager, which we are calling Putting the One-Minute Manager to Work. Bob and his colleagues for the last 10 years have essentially been implementing the three secrets of the one-minute manager in their productivity improvement programs and saving companies literally millions of dollars in performance in all kinds of areas, whether we be talking about safety, productivity, quality, absenteeism, all kinds of areas of improvement. Now, putting the one-minute manager to work is another parable. But this parable is about a veteran manager who reads The One-Minute Manager and can't argue with the three secrets. After all, he says, you know, one-minute goal setting really makes sense. People really need to know what they're being asked to do, and they also need to know what good behavior looks like. He certainly couldn't argue with the one-minute praising, which is the second secret. He said, after all, people ought to be caught doing things right. We have this great tendency to catch people doing things wrong. And then the third secret, the one-minute reprimand, seemed to make sense too. After all, sometimes you have to give negative feedback to people, but you want to do it in such a way that they concentrate on what they did wrong rather than how you treated them. And so the veteran manager thinks the three secrets make sense, but what he wants to know is, if I use them, will it really make a difference where it counts, in the bottom line, in performance? So putting the one-minute manager to work is about his search for the answer to that question. What I want to do on this tape is tell you about the two systems, the two procedures that he learns that are the key to taking the one-minute manager concepts and secrets and putting them to work. The first thing he learns about is the ABCs of management. One of the questions that we have gotten from people is that sometimes they get confused on when they ought to do what when they're dealing with the three secrets. And the ABCs of management really deals with that particular question and problem. In fact, it's a way to help people in the sequencing of the use of the three secrets. A stands for activator. It's what a manager does before performance. It's anything that happens before somebody begins to behave, which is B, or performance. Some people don't like you to talk about behavior. So let's talk about performance. So A stands for activator, B stands for behavior or performance, and then C stands for consequence, or what a manager does after performance. Now, it's real clear that with an activator occurring before somebody engages in some particular performance area, that one-minute goal setting would be a very important part of the activator process. In fact, have you ever played poker? You know how before you get in a poker game, what you have to do is ante up. And in management, the ante is one-minute goal setting. because without clear goals, you aren't even in the management game. Remember the two parts of 1-minute goal setting. People need to understand what they're being held accountable for, and secondly, they need to know what performance standards look like. So 1-minute goal setting is a very important activator. In fact, it's probably the most important one. I do get questions from people, though. Is there any other thing that should occur before you can expect somebody to engage in good performance? Two friends and colleagues of mine, Paul Hersey and Marshall Goldsmith, developed an interesting model that they call the Achieve Model. And I like to use the Achieve Model to kind of be a good checklist for what kind of things you have to think about before you can expect somebody to perform well. A in the Achieve Model stands for ability. The first question you want to ask when you want somebody to perform is, do they have the skills and ability to do it? If they don't, what do you have to do? Well, you have to ante up training. In other words, you got to train them. Training is something that should happen before, then after. In other words, don't wait till people are already a failure or not performing at all and say, well, we ought to really train them now. So training has to happen before. And it's answering the question of ability. If ability is not an issue, then training is not necessary as an activator. C in the Achieve Model stands for clarity. And clarity really has to do with the first part of 1-minute goal setting. What it really means is, are people clear in what they're being asked to do? Are expectations clear? Okay, so C stands for clarity. H stands for help. And what you're saying with help is, am I giving the person the kind of attention and coaching that they're going to need to perform well? And let's agree on that ahead of time rather than after the fact. So I'm not only going to talk about coaching, but do they have the resources, both financial and equipment and material? Are they getting the help they need? Let's agree on that ahead of time. What time is it going to take for me as a manager? What am I committed to do? What kinds of things do they need? So help is the H part of the Achieve Model. I stands for incentive. And what that has to do is, if a person's performance improves or if they reach the standards that are established, what's in it for them? What's the incentive? You might say, well, why would you want to figure that out ahead of time? It is much easier to do it at that time, because then when the performance occurs, the delivery of the incentive is really clear. If they perform, they get it. If they don't, they don't get it. And it's much better to agree on that ahead of time. So I stands for incentive. E stands for environment. Are you providing the environment that they need to be a good performer? If you want somebody to be creative, well, maybe you shouldn't have them in a noisy environment where they have modular walls and that kind of thing. If you want somebody to be a top salesperson and they're in the South in the summer, you better put an air conditioner in their car. Do they have the kind of physical surroundings that they're going to need to be the kind of performer you want them to be? V stands for validity. What that means is, do they understand why you're asking them to do what you're asking them to do? I mean, we no longer have the power that we used to have as kings and queens and all that. People would say, why do I have to do that? Or, you know, why am I doing that? And you'd say, you know, because I said so. And if they didn't, you know, you could cut off their head or whatever. We just don't have the power in organizations today. There's so many other power factors, including the government, legal factors, environmentalists, all kinds of things that are impacting our power, so that we have to be much more rational with people. And validity has to do with why. Do they understand why they're doing? Do they understand the reasons for it? And then finally, the last E in the Achieve Model is evaluation. Do they know how they're going to be evaluated? Do they know what good performance looks like? This is that second part of the one-minute goal setting. So the Achieve model is a really nice checklist to say, have I done all the things I need to do ahead of time? It's just like getting in a car. In order to start the car, what are the things that you have to do? Well, you got to make sure you get it into neutral. You got to take the brake off. You got to get the key in the ignition and all. And so all the activators are saying is, are we ready to get the kind of performance that we want? Once a person has been activated, in other words, all of the before things have been done, then they are off and starting their performance. And that's what behavior is all about. Examples of behavioral performance is writing report, selling a shirt, coming to work on time, missing a deadline, typing a letter, making a mistake, filling an order. These are all examples of behavior or performance. Now let's look at the C. The C is what happens after somebody performs. Let me just back up 1 second and say, make one comment about the behavior. Some people ask us, what about attitudes and feelings? Do you count those? Well, attitudes and feelings are important because they often have a tremendous influence on behavior, but they are not behavior themselves. In other words, we do not deal with morale problems. Unless you can tell us what poor morale results in behavior. Are people coming to work late? Are the quality of the products down? What is happening? See, so attitudes and feelings are important, but since they're behind the eyeballs, they're in the head, and we can't observe and measure them, we don't use them. Behavior has to do with what you can observe and measure. Now, consequence is what happens after somebody engages in some behavior. Now, the second two secrets of the one-minute manager obviously fall in to the consequence area, one-minute praising and one-minute reprimand. Now, with the one-minute praising, that is a positive consequence. And remember, with the praising, you got to be immediate. You got to tell them when they did something right. Don't save it up for a holiday. Be specific. You got your report in on time on Friday, and it was well-written, and I used it with John in a meeting today, and it made you and I and our whole department look good. And then you share your feelings. Let me tell you how I feel about it. I feel super. I appreciate your efforts. I'm proud to have you on my team. So the praising is an example of a positive consequence. The one-minute reprimand is an example of a negative consequence. In other words, it's something that somebody would rather not have if they had a choice. A positive consequence they'd choose if they had a choice. With the one-minute reprimand, remember there's four key things involved. First, when do you reprimand somebody? Right away. Don't save it up for a holiday. Second, you got to be specific on a reprimand. Don't get into that old marital trick, you know, where your spouse says, I'm really angry at you, and you say, well, why, honey? And they said, you know, if you don't know, and now you're in there guessing and all, and they'll beat you up because every time you mention something, they'll say, well, I forgot about that. So you want to be really specific. You didn't get your report in on time. Then you share how you feel. I'm angry. This isn't like you. Everybody else got their reports in on time. It screwed up my whole analysis. So you really share your feelings. Are you angry, frustrated, disappointed? Where are you? And then finally, you end the reprimand with a praising by saying, you're better than that. You're one of my best people. You know, you normally get your reports in on time. That's why I'm angry with you. So the reprimand is a negative consequence. But what you're trying to do with a negative consequence, like a reprimand, is to get the person to stop doing a behavior that they're doing and get back to their good performance. Now, there is a third consequence besides a positive or a negative one, and that's no consequence, no response. You don't do anything. That is probably the most popular response of all. I mean, in fact, we have found that the American way of managing is that when you do a good job, nobody says anything. When you screw up, they hit you. It's really the leave alone zap, leave alone zap. But leave alone, paying no attention to behavior, is a very common occurrence. Now let's look what happens whether a consequence is positive, negative, or no response at all. If you do something and you get a positive consequence, and there are other positive consequences besides praising, things like promotions, things like new opportunities, more responsibilities, better pay, there's all kinds of positive consequences. But if you get a positive consequence, what do you think is going to happen to the frequency of that behavior? Do you think it's going to go up or down? It's going to go up. The tendency is it increases in frequency when a performance or behavior is followed by a positive consequence. What about a negative consequence? What happens when your performance is followed by something negative? And there are other things that are negative besides reprimands, like a demotion, like having your office removed, like losing a salary or a bonus opportunity. If you have a negative consequence, the tendency is that the frequency of that behavior will go down. In other words, people don't like negative consequences, so it will go down. Remember, though, what is negative to somebody is what's negative to them, and so that you think that you might be taking away something that's important, but they don't care about it, it's really not negative. The same way for appraising. If you say to somebody, you've done such a great job, here's a little extra pay, and they don't care about money, but what they want is more responsibility, that's not necessarily a positive consequence. So positive consequences increase the frequency of a behavior. Negative consequences, if it is perceived as negative, decrease the frequency of that behavior. Now, what about no response? Suppose you work hard and perform or do something and nobody pays any attention. Initially, we find that people try harder because they thought maybe you just didn't notice. But after a while, when people continue to not notice, what happens to the frequency of that behavior? It tends to go down and goes down even faster than after a negative consequence. So as you look at those three consequences, which is the only one of the three that tends to increase the frequency of a behavior? It tends to be the positive one. And yet, what is the most frequent consequence that people get to their performance? No response, negative. No response, negative. Leave alone, zap. Leave alone, zap. That's not very motivating. Now, in relation to the ABC model, let me just lay out for you how you go about training someone, because it falls right into this pattern. Because remember, you have a choice of hiring a winner, somebody knows how to do it already and has experience, or hiring a potential winner and training them. There's five steps to training somebody. Tell them what to do, then show them what to do. It's the old show and tell. Both of those are part of 1 minute goal setting, and they are both activators. Then after you show and tell, you delegate is the third step, which is you say, let me see you try it. And now the person is engaging in the performance or behavior desired. Now, when you delegate, do you leave them alone and run off? No. You hang around for the fourth step, which is observe performance. Why do you want to observe performance? The reason you do is you want to manage the consequence. In other words, you want to be there to deliver something after they begin to perform. If you leave them alone and run away and they fail and come back and hit them, that's the old leave alone zap. So the fifth step is praise progress. What you want to make sure that you know is that good performance is a journey, not a destination. And that a goal is a destination, but as a manager, if we don't help manage that journey by managing the consequences, we may never get to the end or the destination at all. So we have tell, show, delegate, observe, and praise progress. Now you might ask, well, what happens is if you go through all of those steps and they don't even make any progress? Do you praise them anyway? No. Do you reprimand them? No. Do you ignore them? No. What you really do is you go back to show and tell. In essence, what you're doing is you either praise progress or redirect. And so redirect in many ways is a fourth consequence where you really go back to the activator and ante up. So the ABC model is a really nice way of summarizing when you sequence what of the three secrets of the 1 minute manager. And if you look at performance of your people, if they're not performing well, one of the questions you want to ask is their performance an activator problem? Meaning maybe you haven't trained them. Maybe they aren't sure what they should be doing. Maybe you're not providing the help. You can go right down the achieve model and check. Or is it a consequence problem that when they perform it, nobody seems to pay any attention? And as a result, the frequency of that behavior goes down. In some cases, it's both an activator and a consequence problem, but the issue is mainly where is the problem area in the activator, the consequence side. Now, which do you think is more important to put your emphasis on, the activators or things that go before performance, or the consequence, things that go after? When we ask people that, most of the time, they put the higher emphasis on the activator. They think that the goal setting is important. When in reality, really only 15 to 25% of the impact on performance comes from activators, things like goal setting, where 75 to 85% of the impact on performance comes from what happens after people to engage in performance. So behavior is really managed by its consequences. So the ABCs really positions the three secrets of the 1 minute manager in a way that makes them easy to use and to follow up and implement on a day-to-day basis. The second concept that the veteran manager learns in putting the 1 minute manager to work is the price system. He learns that to really improve performance, you have to pay the price. Now, price, as you can guess, spells five steps to improve performance. P stands for pinpoint. What you do in the pinpoint stage is determine what are the performance areas of interest. In other words, what do you want to work on? Are we trying to improve safety? Are we trying to accomplish quality? What are we doing? What is the behavior of interest? We have worked on all kinds of performance areas, and they vary all the way from sales to absenteeism turnover to shrinkage, where products are going out of stores without stopping passing the cash register. I mean, there's a lot of different things. So pinpoint says, what are we going to work on? Well, interesting one that a friend of mine worked on, Dick Evans, who was working with a restaurant, he worked on friendliness. They asked him to improve friendliness in the restaurant. So the pinpointed area was friendliness. So we can name a lot of things, but in pinpoint, let's be specific. R in the price model stands for record. Once you've pinpointed what you want to work on, you have to be able to measure it. What you're working on in performance needs to be observable and measurable. Otherwise, we can't do anything with it. So in the record step, you say, how are we going to measure it? You know, what is the safety record right now? What is the productivity rate? What is the efficiency? Where are we now in absenteeism turnover? You have to really work on that. In the friendliness thing, it was interesting is that if you say to somebody, we want to improve friendliness, you know, well, what does friendliness mean? Well, most people would say, well, it means friendliness. So the job after pinpointing friendliness was to find out, how do you determine what a friendly waiter is if we're working in a restaurant? The best way is to go out and ask customers. And in asking customers what makes a friendly waiter or a friendly receptionist, one of the things that they said that a friendly waiter, a friendly receptionist, a friendly bank teller is someone who talks to you about non-business related items like, you know, what do you think of the weather? How long have you lived in town? How's the family? Where are your kids going to school? Those are non-business related topics. Now, what about business related? Well, the business related topics are, you know, The specials for today are, would you like a glass of wine? You know, all those kinds of things. So recognizing that the friendliness piece has to do with non-business related versus business, now what you need to do is count it. We worked with a bank around friendliness, and that was an interesting thing. And what we did is we just stand and observe the tellers for periods of time to count not only how many times they talked about non-business related versus business related. In other words, every time they changed the topic, what was it? But we also looked at the duration. How long did they talk about each? And this one particular bank we worked with, it turned out upon gathering information in the record step that they were 5% friendly. And it was a really efficient bank. You know, you got your transactions done well, but it was a really cold place. People didn't kind of hang around it. So the point I want to make on the record step is whatever you're working on, you got to find a way to measure it. If you can't measure it, we can't do anything with it. Now, some people will say, well, you can't measure my job. Well, our response to that is, well, then why don't we eliminate it? It's amazing how quickly they get interested in finding some way to measure it. You got to measure performance if we want to really have an impact on it. Now, the I step stands for involve. In the involve step, now you start bringing the people to play that can impact the performance. So if we are trying to improve the friendliness of bank tellers, we have to involve the tellers. We want to involve them in three aspects. First is goal setting or performance planning. And what you're doing is that if we found out that they were 5% friendly, then what we need to know is, well, how friendly we want them to be. 65% friendly, 70% friendly. I mean, it kind of sounds kind of silly, but the reality is how friendly do you want people to be? I mean, you can get the place so they're so friendly, but people are angry because they're waiting in long lines because the tellers are being so friendly. So we had to set a goal in terms of how friendly they wanted. In this one particular bank, they decided that they wanted the tellers to be 35% friendly. In other words, you know, wanted them more than a third of the time engaging in friendly discussion, but they didn't want them to get carried away. But it certainly was better than 5% friendly. So what you're doing is you're setting a goal. Now, what we recommend is that the goal be set down on a graph. In fact, you can start the graph in the record stage. And all the graph indicates is along the horizontal axis is time. And you indicate when you're going to be measuring it. And suppose we had a graph with 1 through 7 along the bottom. That could be one day. That could be 1 week, 1 month, 1 year. The shorter the duration between when you are going to measure and give feedback, the more helpful, particularly in the beginning. Along the vertical axis, you put the behavior of interest, the pinpointed area. So on the friendliness, you would have a graph that on the bottom would start from 5% friendly, say moving up to if the final goal was 35% friendly, then that would appear on the graph. And then if it was 1 through 7 counted for days, now every day that somebody observed the teller for a period of time, they could give them a score. Now, in the first week, do you think you can move somebody from 5% friendly to 35% friendly if they haven't been that before? That might be a little big jump. So maybe the first week you want to move them from 5% to 15 or 20%. So what you want to do on your graphs is set the final goal where you're going and where your present performance is, but you want to have bite-sized interim goals so that people can see the journey from where they are to where they want to be. So the first part of the involve is setting the goal. And you'll notice we don't set the goal without the people involved because they know whether it is reachable, and a goal needs to be reachable. We don't want to have goals too easy or too hard. We want moderately difficult but achievable goals. The second thing that you involve people in is developing the strategies for coaching. In other words, now that we have set a goal, and let's get back to our 5% friendly, trying to move up to 35%, what does the person need to improve their friendliness? You know, how often do you need to stop by to give them feedback? Do they need any training? You know, what kinds of things? Would it be good to videotape them so that they can see how they behave? I mean, what do they need? So we agree on coaching strategies, how often you're going to coach, how it's going to be delivered, and what you're going to do. And then the third part of the involved step is developing strategies for evaluation. Now, when you set the graft up, you're really doing that in the first place so that they know how they're being measured. But there's one other part of the evaluation that you want to do here, and that's the incentive piece that we talked about when we were talking about the ABCs. People got to know, what are the goodies? What's in it for me if I do this? Okay, what's in it for me if I do this? Is it, am I going to get appraising? Am I going to get more responsibility? Is it going to be profit share? What is in it for me? So the involved step in many ways is you are doing all your activator work. You're making sure that you have anteed up the things that they need to perform well. Now, C in the price model stands for coach. See, now what you do is you observe performance and manage the consequences. What you're doing is you are carrying through on your agreements on what you're going to do to coach and help that person win. So coaching is just following up the agreement. It is managing the consequences. And then finally, the E in the price model stands for evaluate. Now we look at the graph, follow it to the end, track performance progress, and then we determine, you know, future strategies. Do we want to continue to be tracking this? Do we want to work on this? Do we want to reset the goal? Where are we? Remember, with the evaluation step is that you never give people new information. What you're really doing is just summarizing what you've been doing all along in the coaching and counseling process. So the price model stands for pinpoint, record, involve, coach, and evaluate. And the organizations that Bob Lauber and his people have worked in and our people have worked in have shown significant performance improvement by taking different areas and making a price project out of it. In fact, Bob and I and our companies are willing to say to people, if you let us put the one-minute manager to work in your organization and implement some of these kind of concepts, if we don't double or triple to your bottom line what you pay us, we'll make up the difference. You might say, well, you know, how do you get so cocky doing that kind of thing? It's simple. Nobody ever follows anything up. Even if we weren't any good, we'd have an impact on what happened there. But the fact that we are good and we have a system like price, we can really make a difference in your performance. Now, one last thing that I want to just leave with you on this tape. At the end of putting the one-minute manager to work, the veteran manager says to the one-minute manager, he says, I think I got it. I'm really excited, and I'm committed to implement these things. The one-minute manager said to him, he says, I'm not worried about your commitment. He said, what I'm worried about, though, is your commitment to your commitment. He said, people say diets don't work. He says, diets work fine. People don't work. What they do is they break their agreements. And he said, what you need to do is recognize that you need to give up trying. In other words, what you're going to do in life is either do it or don't do it. When you say, well, I'm going to try to be a one-minute manager, you just set up all the reasons for not doing it. You're either going to do it in life or don't do it. Don't say you're going to try to do it. So you have to say, I am going to put the one-minute manager to work, and I am not only committed to it, but I am committed to my commitment to it, which means that tomorrow I will start to share it with my people. We will sit down and start to make plans on how we're going to use it, and we are going to do it. We're not going to talk about it. So my advice to you is, if you decide to do it, go and do it and have a ball. Your people are going to love it. They are going to perform better. And it's going to be a win-win for you and your organization. Don't go on looking for the next new management concept. Follow up the one that you've just taught your people. Good to be with you, and my best of luck on the application and use of these wonderful concepts.
This is Jeff Blum, host of the radio talk show Human Software. It's a great honor today to have with me Dr. Robert Lauber, the internationally known and recognized expert in performance improvement. Bob and his organization have implemented productivity systems for small, medium, and Fortune 500 companies throughout the United States, as well as the Middle East, South America, and the list goes on and on and on. As I said before, it's a great pleasure to have with us today Bob Lauber. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Jeff.
I understand that you are co-author with Dr. Ken Blanchard of a new book titled Putting the One-Minute Manager to Work.
That's correct.
Tell me a little bit about this book.
Well, Ken and I have been working together for, gosh, it's almost 8 years now. The time just seems to be going by so fast. And when Ken originally was working on the One-Minute Manager, we began talking about the concepts that we were using in productivity improvement. In our definition, Jeff, our focus has been, what are all the things that determine the profitability of an organization and how that happens through their people?
The principles which Ken talks about in the One-Minute Manager, one-minute goal setting, one-minute reprimand, and one-minute praising, are management philosophies primarily. How does management relate to productivity improvement?
Well, I think one of the places, Jeff, that we didn't pay attention to for a while in American management was how important the people systems are in productivity. We were looking at capital, we were looking at equipment utilization, and what we decided to work on in the early 70s was if productivity was really going to be improved and impacted, it had to be done through people. And that, yes, the equipment and the whole financial aspect of productivity is critical, but without it happening through the employees and supervisors and managers in the organization, you will not have long-lasting productivity improvement.
How do you implement a productivity improvement system?
I think the first thing you need to do is go down and find out from the people what is going on and what they see and what their ideas are. The second thing is to really do an in-depth data analysis. Just find out all the things that people are measuring. What are they counting? What are the important measures in an organization? So there needs to be a financial and data analysis, if you will, which tells you how we're doing in each department by shift. And then to combine that with what the people are saying, the subjective element. Once that's done, what's really important is that you then have a training program of sorts in-house, or if you bring in top quality outside people, to teach people the skills that are in both the one-minute manager and putting the one-minute manager to work, but that people need to learn how to use those skills. But the critical part is once they've learned some of those skills is to follow through in implementation. And that once you learn a new skill or get some knowledge, what's critical is who's following up. What are the managers doing? What are the middle managers doing to follow up that people are doing and using the things that they were taught? I think what's critical is that all the people are trained, not just one or two. And by trained, some new knowledge and some things where they can have successes. Because the job of management and in productivity is to make people winners and help them be successful.
How do you justify to your potential clients the cost of, first of all, doing a study, second of all, of doing what it takes to correct the things that need to be done, and third of all, that maintenance program which you're talking about?
It's really important for American management to look at the training of its people as an investment, as if you're investing in a piece of equipment. If you bought a new machine for a factory, which is absolutely critical, and you don't really work with the people on utilizing that equipment or the downtime or the maintenance, it's wasted money. So the way that we talk about it is it's got to be looked at as an investment, and there is no question in every situation that we've been in, the returns are significant and measurable. So at first, it's having to say, okay, am I willing to really invest in the productivity of my people and the long-term payoff for the organization? But once people have done it, the dollar returns are significantly more than is invested in.
Is the return such a long-scale return, in fact?
We see the returns when a company has really committed itself to productivity improvement within 8 months. Once an organization believes in those principles, it then becomes easier to look at two or three significant things that are important. One is for that organization to look from the outside at itself and analyze what we call five factors of improving performance. And the first factor is for everybody to really understand the accountability of everybody in that organization. And by accountability, what I'm saying is that everybody knows exactly what they're responsible for and what good performance looks like. The second is a very simple data system. Some simple ways that people can understand whether the performance is going up or whether it's going down. And they've got to be able to see that in a visual sense. So if you look inside, what you've got to do is say, what information is now being kept on all the important critical performance areas? Who's seeing it and what's being done with it? And all too often we see managers getting these huge computer printout sheets that they don't understand. And it doesn't matter what level in the organization you are, and nobody wants to look stupid, so they just put the data away and they don't look at it. In a good, simple data system, there should be graphs that everybody can see so they can watch trends. And we've done that with coal mining supervisors and oil rig hands and drillers and superintendents, as well as in manufacturing operations and engineers. But everybody needs to see some good, simple data. The third factor is that there's got to be some simple, basic feedback on performance. And as Ken and I have said over the years, feedback is the breakfast of champions. The number one motivator of all people is feedback on results. So if you get this simple data, if one, you know you're accountable for, two, you have a simple data system, then three is how you get that feedback back to the people to let them know how they're doing. Now, the fourth factor, which is really critical in looking at an organization, is what we call their recognition systems. And recognition systems go back to the praising and correcting aspects of the one-minute manager, and that's that if someone's doing a good job, what happens? If someone's not doing a good job, what happens? And so that systematic process of acknowledging people with intangible as well as tangible things for doing a good job is critical. And if you and I are on the same shift and you're doing a much better job than I'm doing, what happens that's different? And if nothing happens different, why should I work harder?
Sure.
So that is the fourth factor. The fifth that's critical that we look at, and again, if I can review for you, Jeff, what I'm saying here is an organization ought to look at its accountability systems, its data systems, its feedback systems, and its recognition systems. And the last thing that we suggest people look at is the skill level in their organization. And there are two basic parts of the skill level. The first is, do people have the technical skills to get the job done? And you need to constantly be looking at if we're getting new equipment, new trainees, how people are oriented. Do they have the technical ability? And if they don't, we have to make sure that we implement those training programs. The second part is the people or management skills. And that how do people get the skills to get things done through other people? And in most companies, the way people get promoted is your best salesman becomes your sales manager, and you not only lose a great salesman, but you gain a poor sales manager.
That's the Peter principle.
Pretty close to the Peter. And we see supervisors managing supervisors who've never had good management skill training. And the basic skills that are in the one-minute manager and putting the one-minute manager to work are those skills that make someone a better manager of others, and to really care and pay attention. So that's the first major area in the book that talks about putting the one-minute manager to work.
Now, you mention in the book about paying the price.
The price is total commitment to improving productivity in the organization. These systems cannot work without everybody from the top manager, the chief executive officer or president, on down through the organization being committed to making this work. And so the commitment is one of time and the belief that this is really going to make a difference. And that's really the price. The price is putting the time and energy in, and the payoff is so tremendous in every company that's made that commitment.
I assume that the senior level executives are the people who make the decisions to bring in your services. Do you find that you have difficulty in showing them, convincing them, that a more humanistic view will impact the bottom line positively?
Well, if you just talk about the humanistic view, that's where we get in trouble. What's important is that this is scientific. It's not just another touchy-feely or just humanistic approach to getting everybody to feel better about the organization. It is a very scientific method that has been tested and tried for over 20 years.
If a company gets involved in the implementation of these concepts, which is one of the most important things that they need to do right away?
They have to understand the second major area that we talked about in the book.
Okay.
And that's the building blocks, in our jargon, the building blocks to how all performance works. And those building blocks are just what we call our ABC model. And that the ABC fundamentally is that A, by the way, stands for activators, B stands for behavior, and C stands for consequence. And that in all performance, which is what behavior is, behavior equals performance, in organization, some things have to happen before someone performs. And all those activators, those A's are training, are telling someone what to do, showing someone what a good job looks like, all the things that occur before someone's going to do the performance, orientation, policy manuals, all the things that happen before someone's going to perform. Then the behavior happens, which is the performance, writing a report, pulling a lever, making a sales call, all those behaviors. Mm-hmm. But what's most critical in that model is what happens after they perform, which is the consequence. And there are three things that can happen after someone does their job: something good, something bad, or nothing at all. And in American management, the predominant style has been nothing at all. The only time someone hears from their supervisor is when they screw up, is when something happens. No news is good news. If someone does a bad job, then you hit them. The thing that we're saying is that consequences really affect performance more than anything else. So if that's the case, if someone's doing a good job, and they are acknowledged for that good job, the odds increase that they will continue doing that. If they don't get any information at all, then the odds increase that they will ultimately drop off that strong performance. So what's critical in management is to pay attention to what happens after someone does something. And that's also what the praising and reprimand area is about, and this is a systematic way of looking at that.
How do you see the future of American management? Where will we go with these principles that you propose in putting the one-minute manager to work and the underlying principles from the one-minute manager?
I think it's really exciting. I think that I totally believe American management is the best in the world. It's kind of funny because Ken and I were talking last night about all the comparisons to Japanese management and the fact that the Japanese learned most of their management techniques from us, except they implemented it and followed through. And yes, there are cultural differences, but I think what's happened is the sleeping giant has been awakened again. And that more and more managers and top executives on a day-by-day basis are really paying attention to productivity, really paying more attention to their people, how important their people are to the organization. And I think that American management really is paying attention to productivity. And I think our contribution is one more piece to help that out. And the reason I'm so excited about our book is that more and more people can see it and use it and do something with it. And I just think this is going to be a great decade for us.
This is Ken Blanchard. What follows is a conversation that Bob Lauber and I had with Ed Stanley from Portland, Oregon. Ed is one of the most exciting entrepreneurs that Bob and I know in this country. He heads up a number of companies, including a compensation company, a financial management company, and a graphics company. The reason we're together today is that Bob and I have been talking with Ed about an exciting possibility of taking some of the concepts from putting the one-minute manager to work, particularly catching people doing things right, and implementing it into companies through the use of business cards and other related kinds of products. Ed, why don't we start off by just having you share how you got some of this initial thinking about business cards and company cards and how it can all apply to putting the one-minute manager to work.
Well, it came out of a trip that you and I took, Ken, to Japan, mm-hmm. where we were visiting companies in Japan to see what made them different of a non-technological nature. And we noticed all kinds of employees running around with company hats on, company jackets, company coveralls, and the company colors. An interesting thing happened. Most of the people there had business cards or company cards, and they had their name on their jackets and their uniforms. So it appeared that the individual's identity and the relationship between the individual and the company were far more developed there than they are in this country. For example, in the United States, our typical client will provide cards for 5 or 10% of their employees, which means 95% of the employees do not have either an individual identity that they can give to other people or a relationship between their department or their company that's in print. The interesting thing about trying to put the one-minute manager to work so that it not only works with everybody but all the time is that there needs to be a system that records catching somebody doing something right.
A friend of mine, Jerry Thomas, said it's the three R's, you know, recognize, record, and reward.
We were, in fact, just finishing what we call an executive feedback session, which is just talking to each of the CEOs, the top managers, and asking how often they get feedback, and it was amazing. Almost non-existent. And so we asked them what we saw their strengths and weaknesses are, things that they like to do, and then we asked their subordinates. And when we came back with the feedback, they were just delighted that somebody had taken some time to give them some feedback on the things they did well, because they're always working on what I should be telling somebody else.
Yeah. What's interesting about people who treat the boss is if you do something right, they say, you know, he should. Look at all the money he gets paid. You know, we expect it. If you screw up, then we're in. How come you sent that memo? How could you have done this and that? So most employees treat their boss with a leave alone zap that we complain that managers do with their people. And so what we have in organizations is really kind of psychological stroke deserts. I mean, nobody's getting to feel very good about themselves in any work. CBS did a study last year that said 80% of the employees in America are dissatisfied with their work. And one of the reasons was that they just don't like the way they're treated. And what's interesting is they don't like the way they're treated, but then they don't treat anybody else any differently. And so people are not getting any, you know, psychic energy.
How do you break that cycle, Ken? If you're concerned about productivity in America and attitudes, and if we think that the solution to our economy and its place in the world is upwards from the people that are doing the work and not downwards from the regulators and the government, how do you break that cycle?
Well, I think that's some of the things we're trying to get at in putting the woman and manager to work, which is everything needs to be tied into clear performance goals. I think one of the reasons why the up and down flow isn't is that nobody's really clear on exactly how they're being evaluated. They're not clear on what their goals are.
And the expectations.
Mm-hmm. And so their boss doesn't know what to pat them on the back for. All they know usually is what they don't want. You know, it's amazing how quick goal setting happens when you don't want something. I mean, I didn't want that. See, and then what happens is a lot of employees don't know what their boss's job is. They don't even know what their goals are. And one of the things we're trying to encourage is people sharing what each other's goals are so that we both can be helping each other accomplish our goals. The system is based on an abundance mentality that everybody potentially can win, not on a scarcity.
One of the messages that's really important for Ken and I is that there isn't a quick fix or magic solution. And what the one-minute manager did was awaken so many things that people already knew. And what we want to take them to now is how to systematically implement the outstanding ideas that came from that book. But if it's not a systematic process of implementing it, it's just one more idea,
thing. You need to crack the shell of the other elements of the corporate culture. For example, our company designs incentive compensation and compensation plans, and our specialty is the financial side of that, so that we're reducing the present value cost to the corporation of compensation plans. And from what I see of what you're doing, yours is the productivity, performance, and output side of it. So while we're reducing the cost financially on one side, you're increasing the output productively on the other side.
Mm-hmm. And if companies can see that, we can get off of this win-lose mentality around compensation and evaluation. Because one of the things that Bob and I both feel really strongly is that one of the things that kills organizations in America is the normal distribution curve concept around evaluation.
Yeah, where just a few people are doing well, and by definition, everybody else is a loser.
That's right. And the minute people get that hint, then they know that you really mean them harm. And now, why should they help you? Like people said to us after we came back from Japan, why do you think quality circles work so well in Japan and they aren't working quite as well in the United States? The main thing in Japan is that they do not mean their people harm. That is a look of a family, that they say, well, what if somebody in the family isn't any good? They say, well, what if you have a child born to you that has a defect? You're going to throw the kid out? No, what you do is you work with them to maximize whatever they can be within whatever limitations or strengths they have. And so then when they get people into a quality circle and they say, do you have any suggestions for improvement? They know that nobody there means them harm. So I sure want to make this a better place. But in this country, we bring people in and we say, do you have any suggestions for approval? And they are trying to figure out who's got the most power in the room, who can hurt me the most, and what do they want to hear from me before I say anything?
Because and what happens after I do say something?
That's right. And so, see, we have all kinds of behind-the-eyeball stuff going on because the basic evaluation and compensation system is a win-lose, not a potential win-win.
How do you see the putting the one-minute manager to work tying in with compensation and incentives? What should people do differently under this system than they've been doing in the past?
So often, Ed, compensation really isn't tied to specific measurable performance, that it is something that is just a given, that your money is just coming or that every year you get an annual increase. What Ken and I are saying is that all compensation needs to be tied to specific performance.
But, Bob, when we talk to large companies about incentive compensation plans, and we're looking for something to tie it to, they're not talking to their people individually. In other words, the dialogue is not going on that establishes goals or individual measurement yardsticks. So if we suggested in the typical company that they ought to tie compensation to individual performance, they'd tell us that it won't work because they don't have those tools in place. How can the one-minute manager deal with that?
Well, there's two parts of that answer. One is, and Ken and I were talking about this again this morning, is that every manager is a member of a team and is a leader of a team. And if in each team there is some goal setting, some direction, some specific measurable goals.
The three secrets.
The three secrets. Then there is a vehicle for that to occur. Now, to take it one step further, what we're trying to teach them is a very simple model, which we call our price model. That in each team, each person who has set some goals really ought to be setting up a price project. And that price project is basically to pinpoint what it is they want to accomplish, to get some data on it so they know where it is and where it's going and when they need to make changes, to involve people in the process, that each manager needs to coach the process along and manage what we call the consequences, and an ongoing evaluation process.
So what does price stand for?
P is the pinpoint. R is the record.
We're gathering data.
The gathering data. I is involve people in the process so that they feel it's theirs, not it's just yours.
You involve them in the goal setting, but also how you're going to supervise me and give me feedback. How often are we going to meet? And then ahead of time, you have to decide what's in it for me if I knock a homer.
Which is where the coaching comes in.
So the C is coaching.
The C is coaching.
I thought
coaching.
The C was the company card we're going to give everybody.
Well, it could be. The C could be both. It could be the consequences, the coaching, and the company card.
All right. What's
and the E is that we are regularly evaluating the process. That it's not something that we sit down and then a year from now we look at it, but we understand that it is an ongoing process.
You know, I see an elegant combination here of all the things we're doing. If we're involved with one hand in individual identity and recognition and helping people feel better about themselves through this card program, and the other side with the financial side of compensation, if we put those together with what you're doing on putting the one-minute manager to work, we're really addressing all sides of the equation of how people feel about themselves, feel about their supervisor, feel about their company, and what their results are.
We've got a statement, Ed, that we've put in the book that is a little different from the one-minute manager that Ken and I believe so strongly in now, and that's that people who are productive, people who produce good results, feel better about themselves. Where what we used to say was people who feel better about themselves are more productive. And we're saying we're changing that. And that's that if you really are productive, you feel better about who you are, and that also ties into a system of feedback.
You know, the thing I liked about the initial manuscript of putting the One-Minute Manager to work is that it showed me what to do after I had bought books for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought after I had read the book and gotten excited about it, and then bought books for the key managers and sent it to them, that it was like I had inoculated the village against some plague and pestilence.
It was just finished. That's
it. My work was over. I've sprayed penicillin over the population and sore throats will now be gone. But putting the One-Minute Manager to work really enabled me to bridge that gap.
Mm-hmm.
It showed me what to do on an ongoing basis. But more importantly, it gave me something that was written in a form that was understandable enough so that all the people who are responsible for the maintenance of the system and the relationships with people could have something to refer to. So now I have to do the same thing again. Mm-hmm. After having read it, I need to buy a bunch of copies, get it out to everybody, but I think it's the right sequence. Putting the One-Minute Manager in their hands initially was a quick and easy to understand frame of reference that now instanced us we needed to do something and to put on a day-to-day basis. And putting the One-Minute Manager to work is act that ongoing day-to-day system, and I'm thrilled about it.
This has been a Knight and Conan production for Simon Strooster Audio.